You're now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host Tommy, and I'm joined by my co-host John Girl today, who's focused a lot on Anoma over the past couple of months. Today we're joined by Christopher Goes, who's the co-founder of Heliax, which is the team behind Anoma and Namada. Chris, how's it going?
Pretty good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's just open the podcast with a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure thing. I'm Chris. I'm one of the co-founders of Heliax, which is a distributed remote first development company that works on Anoma and Namada. Before working on Anoma and Namada, I had several stints in kind of other parts of the blockchain ecosystem. I worked on, as a way to learn Solidity, believe it or not, I worked on a protocol called Wyvern, which was not very popular for a while, but then got picked up by OpenSea and used by them for NFT trading and other things for several years. But I wasn't really involved in that. I was just kind of, at that point in time, a pseudonymous protocol author. Then I was pretty interested by the kind of political polycentrism the Cosmos idea had, you know, in its early stages, and I joined the Cosmos project and did that. What at that point in time was called Tendermint Incorporated, the company developing it, about a year and a little bit before the launch of the Cosmos Hub. And there I worked on proof of stake, and specifically on the part I was most interested in, IBC, Interblockchain. And I worked on IBC through kind of a few different organizations until IBC launched, right after which I started working on Anoma.
That's awesome, Chris. So I think just diving right into it, attents have become a pretty heated word lately, right? It's like going around on Twitter. Everybody's talking about intents. They're talking about Anoma. They're talking about Uniswap X. I'm curious, did you personally come up with intents? Like, was there a moment where it all clicked and this is where you wanted to spend your time? Or did it evolve from something? Like, what was the genesis of building a project around this notion?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I certainly, you know, intents is a word in the English language. English language is this OG decentralized coordination system. So I can only lay claim to be a very minor participant in that. I did, you know, early on when I was thinking about blockchain applications, just thinking about what a blockchain was in the first place, because I kind of entered into the ecosystem, you know, a little bit after college, and I was trying to understand, you know, why would somebody use this? It seemed to me that users were always going to care about things in the world that were represented on the blockchain. So, you know, a blockchain is a kind of coordination device. It's something that you can use to, in conjunction with lots of other software, of course, as maybe I'll get into later, but something that you can use to express your preferences, maybe find other users whose preferences align with your own in some kind of synergistic fashion, and agree to execute some kind of action together. And I thought that, well, you know, as much as I like blockchains from the kind of, oh, they're interesting perspective, most people probably don't. And most people would only use a blockchain if they wanted something. In other words, if they had some kind of intent. And I don't necessarily mean want something like want to get a cup of coffee. I mean, that might, but I also mean want something like want to produce a park, right? That's also an intent. You know, in the natural English language sense, which is the reason I guess I used the term at the time, intent is just why you come to the system in the first place, you know, what you're looking for. So Anoma took that concept because around the time, you know, when IBC was launched, I just kind of, you know, to be honest, I looked at the state of the ecosystem and I wasn't sure if it was going in the right direction. And I don't mean this in any kind of negative sense. I was just like, not, you know, we were venturing into DeFi and kind of taking the conceptual language of the financial system and trying to decentralize it. And it wasn't clear to me, at least, what the sort of coherent theory of product was, right? Like, why would users in the end want this thing? You know, I get why, like, finance people would want this thing, but ultimately finance exists because it's supported by a real economy of stuff and parks and, like, people's lives. And I worried that, you know, just that turn alone was not sufficient to capture a good description of what it is that we want the protocols to do. So for that reason, I kind of took this concept of an intent, which, you know, really at that point was not mathematically precise. You know, it was, I understood, say, how to implement it for Ethereum and something like Wyvern, but I had no idea how to build a whole protocol around it. But, you know, Anoma, thanks to many kind of brilliant researchers and other folks, both inside and outside Heliax, over these few years has tried to develop a protocol and a protocol architecture around this concept that's really oriented around it. So we always start with the user, right? What the user wants. And the user just says what they want, right? And it's our job as protocol architects to try and design a protocol that can give them what they want and exactly what they want and not something they don't. So that's been the design process of it.
Chris, that's really helpful. And I think just to help everyone's understanding, John, it would be helpful for you to give your thoughts on Anoma's vision as a researcher, right? As somebody diving into this, distilling all the work Chris and Adrian and the whole team have done to kind of get your view on Intense and the entire space.
Yeah, absolutely. I can give an attempt to this, and then maybe Chris can correct me if I get some parts of it wrong. So actually, as I was researching Anoma, I found it very, very difficult to answer the question of, like, what is Anoma? Because Anoma is a new project in the space, new infrastructure project, but it is not a blockchain, or it is, like, more accurately, it is not just a blockchain. The best description of Anoma is that it is an architecture which has the fundamental user action in this architecture is intents. So the whole architecture is built around intents. Once you start to dig into this, you sort of realize that intent-centric applications already exist in the Ethereum and other ecosystems. And when I mean intent-centric, you can take it as being like somewhat opposite of like transaction-centric. So in Ethereum world right now, in the early days, you would see people like directly interacting with the blockchain. But as applications become more powerful, we have things like MEV. What ended up happening is that a lot of the applications actually have some sort of intermediary agent between the user and the blockchain. These guys take on different names. So depending on the application, you can hear names like solvers, fulfillers, market makers, relayers. But at the end of the day, all they do is similar at a high level. They actually take user intents, they sort of process them, and then they settle them on chain. If it's Ethereum, as an Ethereum transaction. When I look at Anoma, I see that, you know, they recognize this sort of trend. And instead of these applications living in silos and having their own, you know, having their own intents with their own message formats, with their own like intent pools, they sort of build an architecture that can standardize all of this. Chris, from a 0 to 5, how do you rate my explanation?
That was a 5. I mean, I would just add, you say you use this word architecture, and Anoma Specs also use this word. In fact, they define Anoma as an intent-centric architect, which is quite abstract. And I want to motivate a little bit, you know, because Anoma kind of does things, it seems like, I think, often an unnecessarily hard way. Even sometimes it seems to me like it's an unnecessarily. But the reason for, in some sense, starting from the high level and trying to kind of, Anoma almost goes top down, right? You see some kind of intent-centric applications emerging in the Ethereum ecosystem bottom up. The system wasn't designed for intents, but users have intents anyways, right? So applications are kind of going to, you know, they chase the users, and as they chase the users, the market structure starts to look similar, albeit, you know, currently in Ethereum, pretty fragmented. But the motivation for taking this path of design for Anoma also comes from actually a talk by Moxie Marlinspike, the founder of Signal, called The Ecosystem is Moving. I think it was at 33C3, but I watched it online. And in this talk, Marley explains basically why he didn't make Signal decentralized. And the reason he didn't make Signal decentralized is that he thought if he made Signal decentralized, it would be too hard to change, and Signal would be outcompeted by all of the other messengers in the world. Not because he made some specific decision wrong, but just because once Signal became this kind of decentralized protocol run in all these different places by like federated servers or something like this, which in some ways would be harder to shut down, right? Decentralization has benefits. But Moxie thought that, well, the cost to doing that was that the protocol Signal itself wouldn't be able to change very quickly anymore. And as a result, it would just get outcompeted on, you know, user-facing features like stickers or reactions, stuff like this, by other messengers. And that was why he didn't do it. And I think this talk should be required watching for anyone building a blockchain system, because he's absolutely right. And the curse, unfortunately, from my perspective of a lot of blockchain protocols, even including things that I've worked on like IPC, is that early on in their design, they must make a lot of decisions, right? They must kind of take certain assumptions about what the users of the protocols want, take certain assumptions about what their substrate is, like in the case of IBC, the substrate is Tendermint, right? They must take certain assumptions about the rest of the world, which the protocol interfaces with. And once those protocols are deployed, they're basically impossible to change. So if you look like, this applies to almost everything. If you look at the Ethereum protocol, if you look at IBC, if you look at Tendermint, if you look at even other projects like Polkadot or something like this, early on in the design phase, they're making a lot of assumptions and decisions. And before they launch, especially, it's very easy to change things. You know, in the first 2 years of Ethereum, there were a lot of hard forks, frankly, just to fix bugs and like mispriced state and other stuff like this, features. Now, Ethereum managed a very impressive network shift with Merge about a year ago. But still, that took multiple years, right? Systems become much more difficult to change as they are distributed. And I think, I mean, that's not necessarily a bug, right? It might be a feature. You don't want some random person changing your system, right? But it also means that if you get some of these assumptions wrong, you're screwed. It doesn't matter what else you do right, right? If you build a protocol and, you know, you spend 2 years designing it and you launch it, and one of your assumptions is wrong, like one of your assumptions about the underlying consensus or about the kind of trust model that your users want or about privacy, say, I think that's an assumption that's often been wrong. Some of these protocol designs, you could do everything else perfectly. You could have like brilliant developer tooling. You could have a great sort of community. You could have like a distributed decentralized grant funding program, all this stuff. You could do everything else right and it doesn't matter. Because this assumption is wrong, ultimately, kind of in deployment, your protocol will fail because there's just no real way to change it, to change this underlying assumption. It's baked too deep into the stack, right? So for this reason, Enoma is very, very careful about making decisions because any decision we make is a decision that we could make incorrectly, right? So we always build the protocol trying to make as few decisions as possible, following from this concept of an intent, right? We're willing to assume this. We assume that users have intents when they interact with the system. We assume that they have trust preferences. We assume that they have privacy preferences. Following from those preferences, Enoma's architecture tries to instantiate the structure, which is going to be capable of satisfying those preferences, while not being particular about the decisions of the specific primitives, such as like a specific zero knowledge proof system. There are new zero knowledge proof systems every 6 months, so they keep getting better, right? If we choose a zero knowledge proof system now, then Enoma will just be out of date in 5 years because there will be a better one, right? So we don't want to. We want to kind of abstract that component and to build the rest of the architecture, assuming that we'll have a zero knowledge proof system, but not knowing exactly which one. So that's why when you look at sort of Enoma relative to other projects, it could seem a little bit more abstract in a certain sense. That's quite intentional because we want to capture this essential structure required to satisfy sort of heterogeneous trust, heterogeneous privacy intents without making some decision about an exact primitive, which is just certainly going to change sometime in the future.
Chris, I think that's an excellent answer. There's a lot there, though. Could we maybe unpack that a little bit further? Is it that Enoma can leverage any protocol out there to handle a user's intent to get to their end goal? Or, yeah, I'm a little fuzzy there.
Right. Maybe a good way of explaining it is like this. In a distributed system, there are a bunch of participants, and there's computation kind of happening all over the network. And in the end, typically, as a user looking at the system, you have this view, right? And you care as a user about being able to verify certain properties. So when you are a user interacting with Ethereum, in order for the kind of integrity guarantees of the system to be preserved, you want to verify that the transactions were processed correctly. Because otherwise, maybe someone took your transaction and they, you know, your transaction said send 5 ETH to Alice, but they actually sent it to Bob, right? That wasn't what you wanted. You want to verify, in some sense, that your intent was correctly processed. But we really focus in Enoma on defining parts of the protocol, parts of the architecture, on the basis of how people verify things. We actually don't care so much about how they compute them. So, you know, say solvers. Solvers play an important role in Enoma. And you can think also builders and searchers. There's a lot of overlap between these concepts. Solvers play an important role in what we call counterparty discovery, which is taking different user intents and putting them together. So say if I have an intent that says trade A for B, you have an intent that says trade B for A, a solver could put those together, match our intents, right? Now, solvers need to do pretty complicated things to match these intents. They need to do kind of computational search. They might need to do routing. And we really don't, you know, users don't, they might care about properties, but they typically don't care about exactly how these computations happen. They just care that they get what they want till the end and maybe that it was fair. So we focus our kind of protocol definitions on how on what users need to verify in order to get the guarantees that they care about. and we leave everything else really up to the network participants, right? So different solvers are going to be competing, in fact, on coming up with better solving algorithms to better match user intents. And users really care about the results of those algorithms as opposed to how it's acted.
Chris, that's awesome. I think your ability for Anoma to use anything out there is really interesting, right? And as a follow-up question, and I think this might be a layup given your last answer, but could you maybe just hit on why this structure isn't achievable on Ethereum itself? Like, what is so constricting about ETH or EVM or what have you that you can't build out your vision on Ethereum?
There are really two things about Ethereum that make it difficult to make compatible with intents as we envision them. One is the ordering dependence of the EVM. So the Ethereum virtual machine, the EVM, is, you know, everyone can kind of agree that it's like a little bit unusual. It has 256-bit integers. It has some odd quirks, but none of those are that bad, even though they're kind of quirky. The thing which is awkward about the EVM is that every interaction with the EVM is specified by a sequence of messages sent from one contract to another. So when you send an Ethereum transaction, that transaction is sent to a specific contract. That contract's code starts running, then depending on what it computes, it sends a message to another contract. Then execution flows past this other contract, etc. So this means a few things. One, it means that when users write transactions, they have to specify exactly an order of computation. So they're specifying all of the imperative steps that they want to be executed. So users have to know exactly how the EVM works. They have to kind of reason about, you know, what that imperative computation will do in combination with other ones, like in the case of MEV. And the second problem is that, in some sense, with this is ordering dependence, is that users are actually, typically, they don't care about this so much. Like, as a user, when you send an Ethereum transaction, you are paying to stop the world. You're paying for your transaction to execute in a total order with respect to all of the other transactions. And for every computational operation within your transaction, you're paying for that operation to execute in order with all these message sends between contracts. So this, unfortunately, I mean, you can kind of emulate intents on top of the EVM in, say, Wyvern or Seaport, or even something like Uniswap X is really kind of emulating intents on top of the EVM. But in order to do that, you need to build this like extra contract that really is just an emulator. That, you know, at least you can emulate it, but the thing that's basically impossible to make compatible with the EVM, I don't think anyone is trying anymore, like even Aztec gave up, is privacy. In Anoma, at least, not only, I mean, when you define intents in this kind of user-centric way, privacy is not so much a property, it kind of falls out of the definition directly. So as a user, when I author an intent, what I really think about is not what information I want to keep private to whom, it's what information I want to disclose to whom. Think about it like when you send a message on your messaging application. It would be pretty weird if you selected all the people you don't want your message to go to, right? Imagine that kind of interface. That's ridiculous. You don't want to do that. You want to select the people you do want your message to go to. So we conceive of privacy really kind of in the inverted way as a sort of programmatic disclosure or information flow control. And the EVM just wasn't built to do that, right? The EVM is built as this transparent computational substrate. All of the validators verify transactions by running them. And in particular, there's really no, even if you do a ZK rollup or something, there's no mechanism to facilitate user-defined privacy with the EVM. So for that reason, we have to kind of change the fundamental substrate.
Chris, that's a great technical answer. And just before we get to the privacy component, could you maybe just walk through your, I don't know the best way to ask this, but can you maybe walk through the difference from the user perspective on using something like Uniswap X versus using something like Anoma, like in their end states, like, you know, what would be the key differences? What would be achievable? What can you not do? Be helpful just to bring it home.
Right. So to kind of quickly describe the relationship between something like Uniswap X, something like Anoma. Anoma is a sort of protocol and an architecture. And Uniswap X is like a specific application. So, you know, we hope, in fact, to be able to support something like Uniswap X with Anoma in the future. And to Anoma, Uniswap X is a specific form of intent and a specific solving algorithm. Or I guess they can have multiple solving algorithms, but a specific class of solving algorithm. Now, what Uniswap X does very well is that it kind of clearly defines this form of intent and defines what kind of solver algorithms can be used to process it. I don't know so much about fairness conditions, but I didn't read everything. Maybe I'm sure they're thinking about it. The challenge, of course, with something like Uniswap X on Ethereum is that Ethereum only supports transaction level composability. So when you use Uniswap X, your intents, basically your orders, I don't know which one they call them, go to some kind of off-chain mempool. And this off-chain mempool is viewed maybe by Uniswap X solvers, and they can, you know, use their liquidity and offer you quotes. And if that doesn't work, then eventually it goes to this kind of auction and can probably be settled using on-chain liquidity, right? And this unfortunately means that there are also going to be other systems that are not Uniswap X, like Kelswap, say, or like, you know, maybe OpenSea or some different kind of off-chain order book or intent pool and matching mechanism. And liquidity is fragmented amongst these. So as a user, you send your intent to Uniswap X, right? And you have to make a choice. Do I send it to Uniswap X? Do I send it to Kelswap? Do I send it to, you know, 0x? Do I send it to one of these other places? And wherever you send it to, you're not going to get access to all of the liquidity, because the liquidity can only be composed like later in transactions. So realistically, what happens is that you get some kind of price match, you know, in the intent pool you go to, like Uniswap X, your transaction gets posted to Ethereum, and then some kind of searcher comes along afterwards, cleans up the arbitrage. So as a user, you get a worse price, basically. What Anova enables is intent level composability. So when you use something like Uniswap X, you would express your intent, and that can be composed at the sort of intent layer, at the liquidity layer, before there even is a transaction, with other intents, such as one submitted to Kelswap, one submitted to 0x, one submitted to OpenSea. And this allows, basically defragments the liquidity, and it allows for heterogeneous composition. So suppose that you as a user want to trade A for B, and another user wants to trade B for C. Well, your intents can't be directly matched. But if then there's a third user which wants to trade C for A, or even some other crazy thing like they want, suppose it's not even the same type of token. Suppose they want to sell their NFT, someone else wants to buy their NFT, you're just doing a fungible token trade. You know, when you use specific intent applications like Uniswap or Kelswap, you can't really interface with this liquidity at all, because they're just different forms of intents. But if you have intent level composability, then users who are completely unaware of each other's even application can have their intents composed with each other, as long as it satisfies their preferences. So maybe I sell my NFT and I want one token, the buyer wants to use another, and someone else just doing this fungible token trade kind of ends up being our counterparty, and none of us need to explicitly communicate with this person in order to find them, because the intent level counterparty discovery provided by Anova can kind of route intents to where they need to go.
Chris, that's really helpful. And my last question for you here, this might be a dumb take or a devil's advocate take, but with Uniswap X, can't those solvers like choose the method of which they want to fill the order? Like, are they actually limited by like Uniswap's? I know they're not limited by Uniswap's liquidity, but they can use any medium similar to how Anova would solve a transaction, right? Or
I just want to add a color here. I mean, like there could be interesting things here. I think this is a good question. Like a Uniswap like X fulfiller, right, could in theory like use flash loans to represent some liquidity, etc. I just think it sort of becomes like inefficient to do that if you don't start up from the ground up and like basically have users express what it is that they want in sort of a standard format. Like that homework is left for applications to figure out. Like, how do they now compose in this intense layer? Whereas, like, in the Anova architecture, this comes sort of free. That's how I see it.
Yeah. I mean, to be clear, I haven't examined the exact market structure. You know, the way Uniswap X works, as I understand it, is that fillers can kind of define themselves programmatically, which means that they could source liquidity from elsewhere. Now, they need to do that with transactions. But those transactions could, in principle, feature, like, signed orders or something like this, I imagine. It's still not going to be, it's not necessarily going to be very efficient, because you have to like post all of this to Ethereum so that Ethereum can verify all of it. And when you include liquidity from a bunch of different heterogeneous like proto intent systems, which are in different smart contracts, that gets expensive. It might still be possible. One thing that I also would wonder about is just the sort of the incentive dynamics of, because they're also like Kelswap solvers, right? And they're perhaps trying to use the same liquidity. It seems like you could run into contention here, which you know, Adobe doesn't magically solve, but you definitely need to do some things like form on-demand solver DAOs, right? So solvers do some kind of pre-consensus to use their liquidity so they don't end up in contention later on. You definitely need to agree on an intent. It's not sufficient to agree on a transaction. I guess maybe my answer is I think probably some parts of kind of intent composability can be emulated, but it's awkward. And it's likely to impose costs on the user, ultimately, you know, turning out worse prices.
Thanks, Chris. That's really helpful. Definitely hand over to John now.
Yeah. So I actually want to talk a bit about the paradigms, concerns on intents and your counter to them, because I found that all discourse quite interesting. So for the audience, for some context, earlier this year, Paradigm published a great introduction on intents. And in like part of that write-up was them listing their concerns, concerns that they foresee. And if I were to summarize their argument, they effectively foresee a risk of there being many alternative intent mempools, which, if not carefully handled, may look a lot more permission, private, and opaque than what currently exists in Ethereum today. And then, Chris, you've written an article in part in response to this. You had, like the way I understand it, you had two sort of responses, right? One is that you argue that it's kind of misleading to put this as a dichotomy. So like viewing mempools as being like permission versus permissionless or opaque versus transparent is sort of misleading, and it would be better to imagine this in a spectrum. And then the more subtle point is that, which I want to spend a bit more time on, is basically you don't think this is a task that like an intent pool protocol designer has to define. Though like it's not like these intent pool designers have to define those characteristics, but more so that like nodes in the mempool sort of determine those characteristics by what intents they accept and what information they share with their peers. Would you be able to like elaborate on these points? Because I kind of found that pretty interesting.
My understanding of, you know, Paradigm's concerns is as kind of a reading of what's currently happening in the Ethereum ecosystem. And what's currently happening in the Ethereum ecosystem, I would describe actually as a proliferation of heterogeneous application-specific intent protocols. And this, I think, is concerning. So maybe I should also put this in the blog post. But like, say, CowSwap and Uniswap X and OpenSea and 0x, and many of these protocols they're moving towards intents in their sort of application-specific niches, but they are different protocols. And they have different sets of validators and solvers and whatever other things. They have different sort of intent pool-esque things where users send their intents to, and none of them are compatible. And also, many of them are, you know, end up adding some trust assumptions that they promise that they will later get rid of, or aren't as verifiable, or just like aren't as widely understood even as the Ethereum system and Ethereum mempool. I think one, you know, it's very reasonable to be concerned about this. I'm concerned about this. I think that having heterogeneous protocols makes this much worse, because then you have all these systems that just don't interoperate with each other because they speak different protocols, right? Not only are they operated by different people, I mean, that's one concern, but they're literally different protocols. So if, you know, at the very least, you need to spend a lot of time writing some complicated kind of translation layer to map one to the other. And this, you know, definitely makes, just by sheer kind of protocol opacity, makes the system a little bit less permissionless in the sense that it's hard to join. That said, you know, there's this idea in often in Ethereum discourse that the Ethereum mempool is permissionless. And I think this is false. The Ethereum mempool is permissioned by holding ETH and by being willing to pay ETH for gas. If you don't have a transaction that has a valid signature over at least some amount of ETH, it will be tossed immediately. This is a permissioning system. It's a permissioning system with a very dynamic set of people who are allowed to submit, namely the ETH holders. And it's a, you know, there's a lot of ETH holders, so it's a pretty wide permission set, but it is a permissioning system. And then if you look at something like an RPC, which kind of, you know, issues users API credentials or something, like API credentials are just a different kind of token. So there are, as far as I know, there really aren't permissionless systems in the sort of strong sense in the wild. I don't think they're, you know, over the internet, where denial of service attacks are always risk. I don't think that's really feasible. What we're really talking about here is different kinds or flavors or tokens of permissioning. You know, to be honest, in the long future, I expect a spectrum. So I think one thing that Paradigm is also concerned about is trust. And in particular, I think they're concerned about intangible trust or sort of non-fungible trust. And by that, I mean these large, when as a user, you have to trust some kind of entity a lot to, for example, process your intents without fraud running you, right? That's like the current NAV dilemma. Then building that trust as a relay operator, say, as Flashbots or as Frontier Research or whichever the other ones are now, I don't know, takes a long time and it's hard. And so only very large organizations do that. And this is not very permissionless, right? I totally agree with that concern. But I think this is happening because the trust there is not accountable for and it's not fungible. So as, you know, one of these large entities, I can't really extend trust to someone else. As a user, I can't, you know, I can't necessarily measure whether the solvers I'm interacting with are handling. So Anoma's approach is to standardize the protocol so that new solvers can always spin up, right? They use the same protocol. They don't need to build their new application-specific intent protocol. And that reduces switching costs. And to explicitly account for and quantize trust. As in, you might well have, your solver might well issue a token. And you would need some of that token in order to send intents to that solver. But then, you know, if they process your intents well, you'll keep getting more of the token. The solver is happy because they get, like, basically we want to turn these one-shot games into repeated games. Because if you just do everything as one-shot games where you have to submit your intent, like some anonymized thing, and it might do something you want, it might not, and you don't know, and there's no reason for either of you to be honest in the interaction, then we will get much worse equilibria. It's very kind of difficult to dislodge trusted providers. But if we can turn these things into repeated games by accounting for the trust relationships, then we get a system that's much more fluid. It looks like more like a web of trust, where when, you know, I want to spin up as a new solver, I spin it up, I tell my friends, we start doing this kind of accounting, and people can kind of easily alter the structure of the trust graph, and clients can use the trust graph as information to decide where to route their attempts and measure after the fact whether processing was in line with what they wanted and adjust their kind of trust scores accordingly.
That is very interesting because, like, in the current world, it's kind of fair to say that there's almost a dichotomy in the permissioning system, right? Like, as you said, like, there's a API credentials, which is a very monopolistic permissioning system. And in the other end of the spectrum, you have, like, token gating, which is, like, very plutocratic way to do things. And then you do it once and that's it, right? Like, you have a distribution of tokens and then based on that, people can, like, you define how much activity can every person can do or what actions, what roles they can take. And so, yeah, so I'm very excited to explore, like, in between these two extremes, right? Like, these web of trust style, like, Sybil control mechanisms, permissioning mechanisms. That would make, I think, blockchains look a lot more like less financial and more, I think, social. And I do want to double down a bit, like one more on this discussion. As I understand, like, you really a fan of, like, this lazy protocol, right? You don't want to make decisions, as you mentioned, because the decisions you can make can be based on, like, false assumptions, etc. So, like, as I understand, Anoma is not sort of concerned necessarily with, you know, making applications intent pools, like, permissioned or permissionless or transparent or opaque. And it's almost like wants to be oblivious to that. But I wonder, like, are there any ingredients in the Anoma architecture that, you know, developers or users or applications can use to, like, mitigate this centralization tendencies of intent pools once the activity picks up? Because, you know, as we know, you know, the mempools are very prone to centralization. There are things like Ethereum order flow, like giant builders, etc. So I wonder if there are any, like, parts of the NLM architecture that can be used as a tool to mitigate.
Right. So this is maybe a subtle distinction, but I think it's an important one. It's true that NLM does not try to fix the, say, permissioning details or privacy properties of any specific intent pool. Now, it's not only that we don't want to, we also can't, as in those properties are about what nodes, what messages nodes running that intent pool do in fact accept and who they do in fact send them to. And those are properties, those are decisions that are taken by those nodes, like whatever decision we make in the protocol, right? I mean, I would characterize this understanding is in some sense a generalization of the learnings of MEV. So MEV came along in this concept, as this concept, in some sense, because the original design of Ethereum, I'm not criticizing anyone, like I didn't see this either, right? But the original design of Ethereum made some assumptions that participants, say, in the mempool and validators would follow a certain protocol, like honest protocol, that it turns out were not economically robust assumptions, right? So Ethereum didn't design itself to have like PPS originally, right? Or didn't design itself to have this MEV supply chain originally, but it ended up happening anyways. So there's not really, you know, similar to how in that case, I don't think like Ethereum could have thought of MEV earlier, I guess, but like they don't really have control as protocol deciders of this market structure anyways. It's just going to emerge. And similarly, when I think about intent pool permissioning and privacy, we don't have control over that. It's just going to emerge. Now, that said, we do care about dynamics of that market. In particular, we care about switching costs. We want them to be low. And we care about the ability of the user to measure what's happening. And we want that to be sort of quantified and legible. So a lot of what ANOVA does to give users control over the market structure of intent pools is based around this idea of information flow control. And this is, you know, similar to how earlier I talked about programmable disclosure. The idea that when users are sending intents, authoring intents and sending them around using the software provided by Nomad, they can reason very precisely about where their information goes and how it can be used. As in, they can give instructions to nodes later down the gossip chain to send their information or not send their information to specific parties. They can measure when things come back. They can measure paths taken in the gossip network. We can support this through signature chains, an idea it was originally discussed in this paper, Bitcoin and Red Balloons, I think. So we want to provide a great deal of measurement capability and information control capability or flow control capability to users. Now, in the end, what the market structure looks like is the result of a feedback process. So if users all send their intents to like the Coinbase mega solver, there's just nothing we can do. At the protocol layer, there's nothing. The most we can do with the protocol layer is make it easy, as easy as possible for users to not do that, right? We can give them these kinds of data that they can measure to kind of automatically select different solvers, for example. They can measure the kind of fairness properties they're getting, it leads to over time, and they can rotate their intents amongst different solvers. They can do simple consensus with other users if they want to coordinate on a solver for a particular application, right? ANOVA's market understanding and market structure is always oriented around the idea that, you know, the final market structure is going to be determined by the decisions taken by the user. And what we want to do is give the user and, you know, the interface acting on their behalf, the right data and the right standardized protocol to automatically make decisions about who to send around particular intents to and what to measure, to expect.
Chris, your context on Ethereum and the privacy aspects is pretty interesting. You know, prepping for this podcast, outside of John's, you know, research and great questions, you mentioned that you think transparent blockchains are going away on a long enough time horizon, right? And I'd like to dig into that a little bit in the context of ANOVA. Is that your view because you feel that like eventually we're all going to want privacy, or eventually the architecture is just not well suited long term, and something like ANOVA makes more sense? What is the genesis of your? I think that's a spicier view for sure.
Yeah. No, I think transparent blockchains, maybe mistake is too strong a word. I mean, I think they're a necessary evolutionary step, at least in this timeline. But I do think transparent blockchains will, maybe they won't, like, I think Ethereum will continue to exist, but maybe Ethereum will be guided towards being used in ways that are completely that just don't see any actual user interactions, right? Like Ethereum will be sort of a multi-sig management layer for ETH holders, and all of the actual user transactions will happen adjacent to that on rollups or on a Noma or on other systems, which can provide user level privacy. And the basic reason I think this is that number one, blockchains are a financial surveillance nightmare. They have worse privacy properties than any existing financial system in the world, because all of your transactions could be seen by everyone, like literally everyone. And this, you know, is necessary or was necessary early on prior to the CKPs and such for verifiability. But it means that the cost of dragnet surveillance is very low. The ability of anyone to sort of threaten you based on things they don't want you to do because they can see everything you do is very high. And it is incredibly difficult to maintain any kind of neutrality because everything you're doing is visible to the world. So if you want your blockchain to not censor specific things, or if you want it to kind of honor commitments it's made to other users or something like this, then you know you always are revealing exactly what you're doing to all of the rest of the world. So maintaining these kinds of properties is sort of very difficult, right? So yeah, I don't think the transparent blockchains are sustainable in the long term. You know, no business is going to use a transparent blockchain. They need at least basic privacy in their financial transactions. Users, even those of us who are lucky to live in, you know, semi-democratic society, still are learning that this world of kind of surveillance capitalism is not one in which they want to live. And they want privacy for their transactions. And in the long run, fully transparent systems are just going to collapse in waves of sanctions and lawsuits and arguments. Yeah.
Chris, your focus on privacy is super interesting. And I know that you're, I think, a big proponent or early adopter of Zcash as well, which I thought to be, you know, really cool. And you had some solid views there. What is your take on the ZK landscape for privacy versus the privacy offered by Anoma itself, right? Like, I know I see a new venture deck every day on a new ZK project. I'm sure you're well up to speed on, you know, all the ZK EVMs, ZK L1s, ZK VMs, yada, yada. So what is your take on the difference between those and the privacy offered by Anoma?
Right. Well, to be sure, I am definitely not up to speed. I'm sure there are five ZK EVMs that I don't know about yet. But also, the word ZK is a sort of meme for coordinating capital around funding cryptography. And I think that's useful. I'm not criticizing it. But I'm going to talk here specifically about privacy.
Funding cryptography is definitely a blockchain use case. Like when people ask for the use cases. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the main pro-social benefit so far, right? So privacy. I would see privacy in the blockchain ecosystem as having basically three phases. The first phase, let's call privacy as an asset. The second phase, let's call privacy as a service. And the third phase, let's call privacy as a default. And let me briefly explain each of these. So the first phase, privacy as an asset. I think privacy as an asset we could understand as being basically launched by Zcash and Monero. So this was in, I don't know, 2014 through 2016. It was in the age of altcoins. There were kind of many forks of Bitcoin, and most of them were trying to build a sort of a different cryptocurrency, right? Many of them weren't programmable. A different cryptocurrency with different properties. And some chains, such as Monero and Zcash, tried to build a private cryptocurrency because Bitcoin is not, in fact, private. And in that era, you know, people sort of didn't think so much about interoperability or even applications. They mostly just thought about the currencies, and the different currencies have different features, right? Now that's, I mean, Zcash deserves a lot of credit for pioneering zero knowledge proofs, bringing them from like academic theory into actual practice in 2 years, which is crazy, and kicking off this sort of, the progenitor of this whole ZK space. But Zcash as a standalone currency, which is private, has a few disadvantages, which seem to sort of limit its usage in practice. One is that as a user, it means your choices are coupled. You have to choose to use this asset and get privacy, or to use another asset and not get privacy, right? You can't choose the asset you want and get privacy. And two is that the privacy sets are disjoint. So even if there are more Zcashes, they're all different blockchains. And when users use them, you know, everyone knows which asset you're using, right? So in some sense, it's easier for some adversary to kind of shut the system down because they just pick the assets which are private and go after those. So that was the area of privacy as an asset. And I think privacy as an asset probably ended with Tornado Cash. And I would say that Tornado Cash started the era of privacy as a service. And privacy as a service, which we're still in this era, is one in which privacy is something that some parts, right? Now the blockchain ecosystem is connected. so you can move your assets across it. But there are many different parts. And most of those parts don't have privacy, but now in the area of privacy as a service, some of them do. So Tornado Cash, for example, early versions of Aztec's Rollup, I think, had this character. Different maybe privacy services on Ethereum. I think there's one called Nocturne. And projects like Numata and Penumbra all fall into the class of privacy as a service. And they have many different features, and you know, some of the new ones like Numata and Penumbra have multi-asset shielded pools and rewards, different bridges and other things. But all of these projects are aiming to provide privacy as a service in the sense that you can take your assets, which mostly you already have, you know, BTC, ETH, Atom, stuff like this. You can move them to these services with IBC, with bridges, with sort of cross-rollup communication strategies, whatever. And you can get privacy there for your existing assets. But still, you know, you have your privacy there, then you move the assets back, then you do other things in a transparent fashion. I think we'll still be here for a little while. The third phase is the phase of privacy as a default. In this, we don't live here yet, but I kind of assert that we should be looking in this direction. This is a phase where privacy is actually a thing that people just assume. It's no longer interesting. One in which users think about what information they disclose, to whom, not what information they keep private, and where privacy is something that's kind of just table stakes for applications, and everything is built on the sort of privacy-preserving substrate, so it all has eventual settlement privacy, and even a lot of it has a high degree of solver privacy. And, you know, it's not really, like, maybe something that isn't thought about so much anymore. Like, when you use your bank, for example, I mean, you should worry about whether your bank has data breaches, but generally you're not worrying about, like, the rest of the world. You know, generally you assume that your bank can keep the HTTPS connection secure, and you know, maybe you need to think about whether the transaction you're sending would offend your bank, but you don't need to think about offending the rest of them. So I think once we get to privacy as a default, in some sense, we'll actually be back to the mental model that most users already have when they use technology, but now it will actually match what the technology does. But in order to get there, we really need a protocol substrate which supports privacy as a default. Internova aims to provide such thing.
Thanks, Chris, for laying out your thesis. I don't think enough people have thought this deeply about the evolution of privacy landscape. I also think my thesis is that what can be built on a fully transparent blockchain has been already built, and I don't think we're going to see much new use cases if we don't pass this paradigm. So it's definitely giving users the ability to control information flow is definitely a building block that will grow the pie. I want to shift gear a bit and get your opinion on one aspect of Intense that I saw some people raising concerns on. So, you know, with Intense, user sign, with Intense, user signs what they authorize, and then you have these settlement guarantees, right? So it's not like you're risking any funds as long as you don't authorize something that you didn't intend to. You remain all the safety, right? So the safety guarantees don't change much, but I think with regards to liveness guarantees, I saw some of the concerns. And basically the main concern is that, you know, in the current state, we have all these AMMs. AMMs are some value at rest. And so if there's a blow up, like FTX or whatever, or crypto enters into its next existential crisis and everyone wants to sell, liquidity at rest is way more resilient than liquidity in flight, so to speak, right? And so the question becomes, next time, let's say that the market crashes 30% in a matter of few minutes, will solvers be there to fulfill your intents, or will they be rushing to sell themselves? And whether or not this makes this financial system less resilient, what's your thoughts on that? Do you see any merit in that, or do you not agree with it?
Yeah, I see. I think this is more of a market structure question than it is a protocol question. So,
right, it is true. Yeah.
If you Uniswap, for example, Uniswap, you can understand as having intents. It's a little bit awkward, but basically when you use Uniswap as an LP, you have an intent to provide liquidity and you just publish it on the blockchain. and you lock your assets so that that intent is guaranteed to be there and matchable. And Uniswap V3 even makes this more explicit with like liquidity provider tokens, right? So that's in some sense like access control for your intent. And I think the market structure here is important, but the market structure doesn't depend on whether the protocol natively supports intents or not. It depends on whether liquidity is locked. Even with intents, I still expect some liquidity to be locked. Now, I don't know if I expect, I mean, sometimes people use Uniswap because it's there and it's easy and there's a lot of demand, not necessarily because it's the most capital efficient thing in the universe. So perhaps the distribution of what liquidity is locked for short term will change, maybe more towards the current market structure where a lot of it is short term. I still see kind of both things existing in the future world. I also think that it is important to in some sense, these problems are already here. They're just not maybe explicitly accounted for. So when you have, you know, runs on, when you have massive price fluctuations in stablecoin pairs like ETH/USDC that are used for stuff like DAI, you have actually a certain kind of run on the bank with the Ethereum gas markets. So even if there are no intents in the picture, just the fact that there's a limited amount of compute to process these transactions means that there's a limited amount of reactivity that the market can have. And this, you know, could play out in MEV or it could play out in odd dynamics. I think that is almost a fundamental feature of limited compute. It's perhaps one that you alleviate somewhat by doing more of the verification and less of the compute in a replicated way. So, you know, if Ethereum was like a full ZK rollup and there were sort of fractal ZK rollups, then I think this would help with this. But there's still always going to be some degree of like limited compute. I mean, I think it's something that the NYSE also has. It's just less explicit. You make things easier. I will say the thing that's really hard to do is to do a general purpose system that can have good liveness guarantees, like Ethereum is a general purpose system, in the sense that the protocol does not discriminate between different types of transactions. So if the protocol would be willing, like proposers or builders, who do discriminate, but not in a sort of systematically enforced way. If the protocol is willing to discriminate, like put all the CDP, you know, liquidations or changes first or something like this, or kind of change, fix the order of Oracle updates, financial market updates and stuff, then it can provide more guarantees that certain stuff updates quickly or kind of updates in a specific order. But without the protocol seeing a little bit more into the semantics of what transactions are doing with respect to sort of market structure, I think that's very difficult. It's a good question, but I think it's more market structure than
I think intent. I think this is a wonderful answer. It's like a great context. And I can't wait for AMMs in the intent pool. One final question on my end that I'm curious to get your thoughts on. In the research day, you have given an example of prisoner's dilemma as a problem that intents can would be very suitable to solve. So, for again some background context, prisoner's dilemma is this like game theoretic thought experiment. You have two individual parties. These parties can either cooperate or betray each other. And then depending on their action, the game results in different ways. Importantly, in any case, they cannot communicate with each other. And so the ideal case is when both of them cooperate, but in the classical prisoner's dilemma, the individual received the greatest payoff when they betray the group. And so it's like really hard to arrive to this ideal state. And the example you gave with intents is that intents are like, you know, binding commitments in their nature. And so you can actually sign an intent. You don't have to communicate with your counterpart. Let's imagine in this like thought experiment that we're one of the individuals in this prisoner's dilemma. So you don't have to communicate with your counterparty. You can just sign an intent, say, I will cooperate if my counterparty also cooperates. And then your counterparty can just sign the same exact intent. And then once these intents are met, both of us will find ourselves in this like ideal state, right? So that's like a very a subtle, but I think a very, very powerful way to use intents. I wonder, have you given any thought into some like real world examples of this, not like a thought experiment, but a real world example where intents can empower like positive sum gains that would otherwise be like maybe inefficient or like not feasible, not unlikely?
That's a great question. To be sure, this kind of concept or sort of understanding of the relation of prisoner's dilemma to blockchains and intents is not unique to me or intents. It's also something that Virgil Griffith mentions in a blog post about Ethereum from a few years back. Sheen Flashbots has done a bunch of research into the kind of relevant mechanism design and game theory literature of credible commitments, program equilibria. But when we turn to sort of real world applications, I mean, typically it doesn't look like the prisoner's dilemma, right? Like maybe this would be useful for people who are alternatively jailer and jailee, but that doesn't arise so much in the context we're currently considering. But I would say stuff like collective decision making to fund, you know, public or frankly private goods of mutual interest is a problem that I think operationalizes pretty nicely. So by way of concrete example, think about Kickstarter. So Kickstarter is a way for people to propose things that they want to produce. Often these are kind of blurry on the line between public and private goods. Like, you know, they're making a card game, but most of the labor is designing the game and actually printing it is the cheap part. Or they're making a community space, or they're making, you know, some tech thing, there's some upfront cost, right? So the lines are a little blurry. But people on Kickstarter is supply side driven. People go there and they post the thing they want to do and try and get enough people to donate such that, such that they can actually produce it. And this is very powerful because it allows people to kind of collectively fund these things. Like when you think of your bank, the card game, and individually, you can't, even if you want the card game, you cannot front the whole cost of designing it. That's much too high. Like it's not worth it for you if you have to pay, you know, $10,000 for someone's labor to design the card game. But if you can split the $10,000 with 10,000 other people, now you only have to pay $1. And that is like $1 for printing, $1 for design, $2, great. So this I would understand as a kind of, you know, it's not exactly prisoner's dilemma, but the utility structure of the game theory has a similar character. And where I think this becomes interesting with a system like Enoma, which provides general counterparty discovery, is that you can also do this on the demand side. So what Kickstarter does not allow you to do is to say, I want someone to produce X, and then find other people who also want X for a close enough definition of X. That's quite difficult to do with, you know, Kickstarter's interface, just you post a project, right? In order to really do this counterparty discovery on the demand side, you need some kind of protocol which can understand, you know, what people are actually asking for and reason about how similar that might be, or, you know, when it's exactly compatible, and kind of put them together. So one application we're considering for Enoma is this kind of demand side crowdfunding, where not only can someone post something they want to do, but someone can post something they want someone else to build, or they want to collectively build, and find a bunch of other parties who also want that thing to exist and who are willing to pool their funds together, you know, almost like a buyer's club or a buyer's cooperative. These things exist in some places in order to fund the production of the object in question.
And then, like in this, if I were to take this example one step further, you would end up with an Oracle problem at the end of this, though, right? Because like you would want some credible parties to attest to either successful or unsuccessful execution of this, like funding. I know Enoma is like not a solution, or nor claims to be a solution to the Oracle problem, but yeah, I'm just while you're here, I can tap into your brain. Maybe you have some ideas here on how that may evolve in the future.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. You know, Kickstarter also suffers from the Oracle problem, right? And I would say that they kind of tried to solve it by building a very primitive trust network. As in, you know, you can create a profile on Kickstarter when you launch projects. You can launch multiple projects. And when if you go watch a video for one of these projects that's trying to raise, you know, ranges from a few thousand to a few million dollars, people always include basically like evidence of other identities to demonstrate that you could trust them. And I definitely see that kind of, you know, trust networks are inevitable. And I would see a similar structure emerging. Maybe the difference or the thing we would want to enable with Enoma is that it becomes a little bit more quantizable and easy to reason about, because the protocol itself is actually capable of representing trust structures. As opposed to, you know, Kickstarter is not capable of representing trust structures, right? People just post links to other stuff, and, you know, users have to kind of figure out what it means to them. But Enola is already worried about representing trust structures between users and solvers, between different chains, et cetera, and the protocol machinery required to do that is independent of the actual reason for trust, right? It just allows for measurement and allows for accounting of all of these different dimensions of trust between different identities. So you, for example, concretely, you as someone using this kind of service could see, oh, like this person is claiming to produce this thing. I have these kinds of trust links. You know, it results this sort of gestalt numerical score. Does that look like, based on past interactions and history and stuff, is that likely to turn out reasonably well or not? And I could also imagine for Kickstarter typically stays like most of the projects don't go past, you know, 5 or 10 million. But I could imagine for larger scale things, you would have maybe more systems of checks and balances, some kind of decentralized court arbitration like Claros in the case of disputes, you know, more components to this trust network. But I think even, you know, Kickstarter at least is like a real world demonstration that even with a really slapdash, haphazard, not cleanly designed, not cleanly reasoned about, and not super easy to use trust network, users still use the product anyways because they want the thing, right? They want to collectively fund these kinds of goods because you can't get that anywhere else. And I think there's a similar argument for, you know, starting off with something that's definitely not going to be perfect. You know, we can't solve the Oracle problem. Like, you know, users use English to describe what they want, what they're going to build, and we can't say whether that actually happened or not from the protocol's perspective. But we can build this kind of surrounding trust infrastructure, which will allow users to, over time, build relationships with each other, with suppliers, et cetera, kind of build this network of mutual recognition and predictability.
Chris, to end on somewhat of a lighter topic, can we talk timelines for Enola? What are you looking forward to next? What should people look forward to?
Timelines, oh boy. I discovered that when I was an engineer at All in Bits, I was really good at estimating timelines because I was extremely skeptical of whatever the management would say. I would like, yeah, you said you're going to launch next month? No.
Next quarter.
Right. And now I realize that I'm in the opposite position, and I don't know if I've learned anything because so far some of my estimates have been wrong. So take that grain of salt. But the next thing we're launching is what we call the Enola RFC, or Request for Comment. And here we kind of take inspiration from a bunch of previous protocols, like those released by the W3C, IETF, such as TCP/IP itself, the Internet Protocol. And we want to release specification documents for Enola, alongside a bunch of explainers, example applications, stuff like this, you know, reasoned through in a pretty high amount of detail. Not a full implementation, but kind of a full structure and description. Such that people can offer comments on the design of the protocol and to kind of tell us whether or not it would work for them, whether or not we missed anything, stuff like this. With Enola as a kind of new entrant and an entrant which changes a lot of the basic concepts used in these distributed systems, blockchains, it's very critical, I think, more than anything else, that we kind of establish mutual understanding with the people who we hoped might use Enola or might consider it for their projects. And so we want to start off by doing that with the RFC. And that we're hoping to launch later this year, within the next few months. Enola, the kind of live implementation, I'm just going to say sometime 2024.
I like it. I hope you beat that. And I forgot to mention this at the start, but just a quick disclosure that Delphi Ventures is invested in Enola, and we're very happy to be. But Chris, I want to thank you for coming on today and sharing your vision and all this info. And John, to you and the research team for all of your incredible research on Enola and to co-host this one.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Chris. This was really fun.
Thank you so much.